If you do mind, then you'll just have to listen to me read them. All right? But Genesis chapter 44. As you know, we've kind of left the situation here is where all of Jacob's family, it's now time for them to return home. And Joseph sets up a test for him. Now, remember last week we kind of left off. He was being overly kind to him. They came into his home and all that kind of thing. But Joseph has set up a test. Now, they still don't know that he's Joseph. Keep that in mind. They're all still unaware of such things. And so what's happening is he wants to make sure that they're different people than they used to be. He wants to make sure that they're not the same kind of people that they were when they sold him into slavery. Are they treating Benjamin okay? Are they treating him in such a fashion that it would be cordial and be nice? And are they being the kind of people they should be? And so he sets up this test. So verses 1 and 2 kind of sets the stage for this. It says, talking about Joseph, he commanded the steward of his house, saying, fill the men's sacks with food, much as they can carry. Put every man's money in his sack's mouth. And put my cup, the silver cup, in the sack's mouth of the youngest, and his corn money. And he did according to the word that Joseph had spoken. So here's how he's setting them up, okay? Not only is he filling up their sacks like he always had. Not only is he putting the money back in the sacks like he did the first time. But now he's putting a very valuable cup in Benjamin's sack without him knowing it. All right? And we'll find out the reason here in just a moment. But he does this. Now, I want you to understand something about this cup, because this is not just a normal, ordinary, everyday cup. We're talking about a very special cup. It wasn't uncommon for the Egyptians, for example. They put a lot of stock in divining and being able to prophesy and all the things that Joseph has become known for. All right. Now, obviously, Joseph is doing so in the power of God. But in Egypt, that's neither here nor there. You know, they just know that he's successful. They know that he's got it right. And so what's happening here is he takes this cup that would typically, because it's given to someone of his position, not only for him to use personally, and it's only for his personal use, but it's also because they would typically use this particular cup for like divining, you know, the way the water's, moved and all that kind of thing. Now, obviously, that's not something Joseph is using, but it would be something that would be given to him because of the Egyptians. And so it's a very special cup. But in addition to that, it's a valuable cup. It's a silver cup. And so he says, listen, I'm going to take the most valuable thing sitting on the table. And it's something that would have been sitting on his own table, not even the table they were eating from, or the other Egyptians. Remember, there was three tables. Would have had to taken this from his own table. And he says, take that cup and put it in there. Because that would signify, would make it very clear that he didn't just take a random piece of, a plate here or a plate there or a cup there, but it's something very specific. And so he, you know, would have stolen from the very individual that's been kind and generous to all of them. All right? And so that's a situation. So he's setting them up. All right? Verses 3 through 5, the next morning the brothers get up and they leave Egypt, head for home. And when they do, then Joseph instructs his steward, go after them. And he tells them what to say, what to do. Make sure, you know, that you accuse him of stealing this cup, you know. And so, you know, he gives the steward all the exact things to say. Now, it never tells us. It always just talks about the steward going. But keep in mind, this steward probably didn't go alone. He's got a band of soldiers with him. I mean, he's got troops with him. He's not just out there all by himself. And so his accusation was to include, and it's interesting because he is told exactly what to say. Joseph says, say this, all right? And so the steward's got to rehearse this, and he's got to say it just the way Joseph wants it said. He can't just decide on his own to say it any way he wants. He's got to follow his plan, all right? And so what happens here is he tells him, he says, make sure that the accusation is this. I want to make sure they know that I realize that I treated them really well, and they've treated me evil. Make sure that he hears that, you know, after all the good that we've done for them, how could you do anything so evil to us as to take this thing from us? All right? So he sets them up in such a fashion because he wants to see how they're going to react to that. it's got to be a precarious situation because they know they didn't do anything wrong, yet here they are being accused. And so at this point, when they come and he makes all these accusations, there's really nothing they can do. And so here they are, and they're being hunted down, and this is presented to them. Now I want you to put yourself in their position because, number one, what are they going to do? I mean, in all honesty, number one, they could be killed just in a moment. Well, you know, if they put up a fight about this thing, well, let's just overtake them and go home. Well, that'd be a pretty stupid thing to do because, number one, they probably couldn't overtake them. But number two, then you're going to get all Egypt after you. Egypt's like the leaders of the whole world. Not only that, but your only source of food, and you have no idea how long this drought's going to last. You may have to come back for more food sometime or another. So you don't want to destroy your food source or your whole family and everybody's going to die. So they're in a really precarious situation. They can't do much. They're at the mercy of the Egyptian army here, all right? And then verse 6, basically, Stuart caught up to him and he rehearsed and instructed all the things that he was told to do. And then verses 7 through 12, the brothers did kind of protest and defend their integrity, all right? They said, wait a minute, this is just not something we would ever do. I mean, and then they did the same thing, you know. They said, now, wait a minute. The first time we went back, our money was in our sack. Now, you guys know our integrity. When we came back the second time, did we not bring that money back to you? You know, it wasn't like we're trying to steal from you. So they defended their own integrity and defended themselves in all of this. So, you know, they're trying to say, hey, listen, we're innocent, and, you know, we don't want to be held accountable for something we didn't do. And so the accusation is, verse 10, the steward amended that judgment. Well, let me back up. The accusation is you have something more than that. You have stolen something from the table. And they said, well, no, we haven't done it. And in fact, they were so convinced of it, they basically said, listen, whoever stole the cup, you can kill that person and the rest of us will be servants. That's how convinced we are that we're innocent. Nobody here, none of us would have stolen such a thing. But if you find it in one of our goods, that individual can be killed, and then the rest of us will be servants. And it's kind of neat and kind of funny here because the steward is like, maybe he wasn't expecting that, I don't know, because he has probably very strict instructions as to what he's going to do and what he's going to say because he's got to take Benjamin back. That's the key. And he knows that's the key is to get that young boy back to Joseph. And so, of course, he's not wanting to kill anybody. He's not out for making all the rest of them servants. He don't care about the rest of them at this point. He just wants to get Benjamin there to see how they'll react to that. So the steward amends all of it. No. Here's what we're going to do. Whoever has it is just going to come and be a servant, and the rest of y'all can go home. All right? Because if they've got freedom on the line, are they going to just leave Benjamin? That's what he wants to know. That's what Joseph's trying to find out. Are they going to stand with Benjamin, or are they just going to let him roll, and let him go? And so that's what they do. And so you find that when they search it all out, then obviously they find this thing, this cup, in Benjamin's sack. Again, by the way, there's another clue that takes place here again. The steward searches them out from the oldest to the youngest. Another clue that they know something, all right? They've got a little insight. Now, I don't know why these brothers don't pick up on any of these clues, but maybe they just wouldn't have any reason to. But nonetheless, you get another little clue there. But anyway, they found this cup in Benjamin's sack. Of course, the steward knew it was going to be there. And then verse 13, I want to read verse 13. Verse 13, then they rent their clothes and laid every man his ass and returned to the city. So what happens here is this. He says, you know, they were so angry, they were so upset that all of this took place, and that tearing of your clothes is a symbolic act of saying, hey, listen, you know, this is bad. This is a bad deal. We're not in agreement with this. Something's wrong. Something's amiss. And so it just demonstrates their heartache. You see this happen in the New Testament too, by the way. You remember in Acts 14, what takes place there when you've got Paul and Barnabas, and you know they're doing a lot of things and they're serving God, and people decide that they must be gods and they call them Jupiter and Mercury, I think it was, and when the people did that, it says they rent their clothes. The idea is saying no, this can't happen. You know, we can't ever let something like that take place, you know. And so, you know, I know a lot of times today people would be, you know, elated if somebody would think they were gods or lifted them up and thought they were something wonderful, but that's not the case. And even here, they're making sure that, listen, my emotions, you might not get the full impression with just my facial expressions or the way that I talk about this thing. I want to make sure you get the whole impact of how heartbroken I am or how angry I am or whatever the emotion might be, and they rent their clothes, all right? And that's what takes place here. And the brothers then, so what they do is they go back to plead for Benjamin, and they certainly can't return home without him. And so they go back to plead for Benjamin here. Verses 14 and 15, the brothers once again, when they get to Joseph's home, Joseph hasn't left yet to go do his daily chores, and they fall on their face before him and want, you know, to make things right and to plead the case for Benjamin and try to get him off the hook. Even though they were free, they did come back, which is a good sign. Joseph, you know, they're kind of making steps to pass this test that Joseph's put before him. And the interesting thing is that Joseph tells them is, I find it kind of comical. He says, listen, my position, I divine. I tell futures. I prophesy. Did you not think I'd know where you were? Did you not think I'd know what you did? Now, the interesting thing is he's just playing on them. He's just messing with them, you know, because what he's doing is he's making them think that, you know, that he's a bad guy here. He does this whole good cop, bad cop thing, all right? The good cop, when they come in, he takes good care of them. You know, the bad cop now, when he finds one of them having stolen something that he actually planted there. So he does the old good cop, bad cop just to see how they're going to react and to see what they're going to do. And it's interesting to me because when he does this, he's kind of like a magician. You know, when you go and watch a magic show, and we know that these guys aren't really doing magic. We know that. They're not doing magic. But some of them are so good at it, it's unbelievable. But we know they're not doing magic. In reality, it's some sort of an illusion. Well, that's kind of what's happening here. It's set up. Everything is set up. They've got it set up so that it looks like it. And all he's doing here is just kind of playing a game with them to see how they're going to react. Do you not know that I was going to find out about this? You know, and on their side of the coin, they're thinking, yeah, no kidding. That's why he's in this position. But on his side of the coin, he's like, well, I planted it there. I knew it was going to be there. You know, so that's the whole game that he kind of plays with them. And so, you know, he's doing that bad cop thing with them. Then verses 16 all the way to 34, what we find is the crux of this chapter. And this is what I really want to kind of deal with, because I think this is the important part of this whole picture, is Judah steps up on behalf of Benjamin. And when Judah steps up on behalf of Benjamin, he intercedes for him. And most of what we see in these verses here is basically Judah retelling the story about all that had taken place, how he promised his father he would do this, and you know, how he promised that he would stand good for Benjamin, how he, you know, and all those kinds of things. If you're not careful, you'll just gloss over that and think, well, he's just retelling the story. But there's some importance in as he tells that story, because here's some things you need to understand. Don't forget, Judah is of the lineage of Jesus. Hey, is that correct? You guys are with me on that. All right? So we're going to see a picture of Judah here that is a portrayal of Jesus Christ in this whole thing. He is sent by his father, given instructions by his father, and his goal is to please his father in all of this, all right, to save Benjamin, all right, to preserve Benjamin. And so Benjamin now has been caught. He's guilty, all right? They found this thing in his sack. He's guilty. And so Judah now is going to intercede for Benjamin. And so the picture that we see is a really important picture for us, because we see that picture of Jesus Christ who intercedes for us. We see that picture of Jesus Christ who was sent for the sole purpose of keeping us safe and giving us that salvation. Now, let's look at and break it down just a little bit here, because I kind of want you to see this. There is a penalty to be paid, all right? Benjamin's guilty, as far as everybody's concerned. Benjamin's guilty. And there is a penalty on Benjamin's behalf. The penalty in this case is he's to be a servant for them. All right? So there's a penalty to be paid. All Judah is doing is this. I want to pay the penalty for Benjamin. Let Benjamin go, and I'll take the penalty. Is that not what Jesus Christ did for us? He paid the penalty for us. You know, we're sinners. And every one of us have a penalty for that sin. And so what happens is this, is Jesus steps up and says, I'm going to pay the penalty of your sin that you might be able to go free. And that's exactly what takes place for us. In Genesis 44:16, look at how that's worded there. And Judah said, what shall we say unto my Lord? What shall we speak? How shall we clear ourselves? God hath found out the iniquity of thy servants. Behold, we are my Lord's servants, both we and he also with whom the cup is found. So he is willing to pay that penalty for Benjamin. He's saying, listen, I'm going to take the guilt here. I'm going to take the guilt. We're as guilty as he is. Now, they had no knowledge of the cup being in his sack. And for all they know, Benjamin stole this thing. And they're saying, the penalty is mine. I am going to become that victim as well. That criminal as well. All right? So as much as Jesus Christ becoming our sin. Jesus Christ became our sin. Jesus Christ, there. If you're not careful, when you're talking about Jesus Christ on the cross, he didn't just take our sins, he became our sins. And I know that's hard for us to grasp because he has no sin. He who has no sin became sin for us. He didn't just put his sins on our shoulders like you see in the Old Testament with the lambs. You know, he became our sin and died for us. So it's an amazing thing. So what Judah is saying, he says, I will become the guilty party. I am guilty. Let Benjamin go. I will be the guilty party. All right? Then verse 17, just to throw this out there, Joseph gave everyone else a free pass, and he was only going to keep Benjamin because he did want to see their reaction, all right? But Judah has stepped up. Now, the second part of this that I want you to see is not only do we see Judah in the likeness of Christ in that he is willing to take the penalty of this sin, but there is a second thing that I think we see in this as well. In verse 34, he says, for how shall I go up to my father, and the lad be not with me, lest peradventure I see the evil that shall come on my father. He's made a promise to his father, and his desire is to please his father. He doesn't want to see his father grieve. Now, look at that. I don't know. I think sometimes we forget to look at this whole picture in this respect, because what we find is that Jesus Christ and what he did was pleasing to the Father. This is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased. All right? What is the pleasure of the Father? Think about that for a moment. What is the pleasure of God the Father? That all men come unto repentance. All right? That all people be saved. And now there's only one way that can happen, and that is for Jesus to step up on our behalf. It's the only way that can happen. So it would please him then. That's why it pleased him to bruise him, as we found in Isaiah. That's why it pleased him to bruise him so that you and I could be saved. Because ultimately, he created us for fellowship. We were created for fellowship. And so keep in mind that it brings us back into that place of fellowship with him. All right? But there is actually even another one that's not in relation to this, but let me just throw it out because I don't want you to think that I overlooked this. But it also pleases the Father to glorify the Son. And we need always to remember that. All right. The more Jesus Christ is glorified, the more God is pleased. All right. Because ultimately, that's what he does. This is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased. Did he not glorify Jesus Christ? The Holy Spirit speaks of no one but Jesus. All right. So does he not glorify Jesus? So when we're talking about Jesus himself, we want to make sure that we understand that ultimately he needs to be glorified. But this whole statement that God made in that this is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased, it was made in regard to the baptism. Because what was the baptism doing? When Jesus was baptized, we all know it wasn't because he was a sinner. That's why we understand and know that baptism isn't necessary for salvation. We understand and know that it's symbolic. It paints a picture. Jesus Christ painted that same picture when he was baptized. He understood and knew that he would ultimately have to die on the cross of Calvary. He knew that he'd have to pay the penalty of that sin. He knew that he would be resurrected. He knew all those things would take place. He was simply prophesying in his baptism the death, burial, and resurrection that he would have to experience. But in doing so, what we find is he is acknowledging that he was going to die to satisfy the penalty of that sin and be resurrected so that we could be free, so that we could have that resurrection as well, so we could have life. Right? So that whole picture is painted in baptism. Now, if we go back to Judah, what we're seeing here is Judah is willing to say, okay, I'm going to take the place of Benjamin, and I understand the penalty. I get it. But I want, and ultimately I desire, for my father to be pleased. He couldn't bear this any other way. His desire is that Benjamin come home, and he would be far happier for me to pay this penalty so that Benjamin could come home. Please the father to bruise his own son so that you and I could come home. And I think that's just such a neat picture, but that's the picture. So all that Jesus did was to please the Father who sent him, and we find that same picture in the case of Judah. Any thoughts or any questions on any of that? Yeah. Well, he was to keep him from killing them. Yeah, Judah and Reuben, I believe it was, that did not want any of that. Reuben didn't want any of that to take place, but Judah is the one that came up with the idea of selling him into slavery so he wasn't killed. Simeon and the others, they was just going to kill him, and he's whoa, here's an opportunity. Let's just sell him in slavery, but Reuben was off somewhere when all that took place. Off watching the sheep or whatever, because he didn't want to do anything. But Judah didn't want to see him die. He just wanted to get rid of him. Absolutely. Any other thoughts? All right. Sorry we had to cut it kind of short tonight. We've got to get a little business done. But are you guys still staying up with this in Genesis? You enjoying it okay? All right. You know, there's a lot of pictures there. There's a lot of things that take place that if you're not careful, you'll just gloss right over them and not see them. But they're there, and they're good. All right. All right, well, let's go ahead and consider ourselves then in order for the transaction of business, because like I said,